But I've yet to hear from God. So unless I hear from Yahweh, Jesus, Allah, that they are not real, I'm going to say they're real. I'm going to take their word over yours. Because what if a fanatical Christian who blows up abortion clinics, or a fanatical Muslims who beheads infidels, or a fanatical Zionist who, you know, wants to stomp out Palestinian babies, come and tell you, the passive believer, comes to you, the good Sunday Christian, the good holiday Jew, you know, Yom Kippur and Hanukkah type Jews, come to you, good, passive, socially digestible Muslims who don't get too crazy with it, who don't force your wife to walk several paces behind you or beat her with a rod that's no thicker than your thumb and all the other sickness that is in the Quran. You know, all you good ones, what if the fanatics come to you and say, no, you're not the real Christian. You're not the real Muslim. You're not the real Jew. I mean, what gives you more authority to say that these fanatics are not real than they have to tell you you're not real? Because if you read the scriptures, if you read the Torah, if you read the King James Version or the Douay Catholic, you know, pre-Protestant Bible, you know, if you read the Quran, if you read these holy texts, you would find that the beheaders, the bombers, the evangelical missionaries, they are the real ones. And you're not keeping it real. You're the one that's not consistent with the doctrine. You who don't beat your children, who don't subjugate your wives, who don't violently and relentlessly spread the gospel and impose it on non-believers. You're the ones who aren't the real ones. And all the real ones are being denounced by the good ones, so-called good ones. See, being a good person and being a good Christian is not the same thing. Being a good Muslim and being a good person is not the same thing. Being a good Jew and being a good person is not the same thing. See, if you're a good Christian, then it doesn't matter if you're a good person, because it's about God. It's about things in the clouds. It's about the afterlife. This world is your dominion. The animals and all the women in it are here to serve you. You can do with them as you please. As God has dominion over the world, so hath the man over the livestock. And you know, by modern day sentiments and by ancient sentiments, true. Because what was wrong back then, they understood what was wrong then was also wrong now. And vice versa. So it wasn't about good. King David was not a good man. The prophet Muhammad was not a good man. But they were holy men. They were they were all fictional. But I'm saying, according to the characterizations, even Jesus Christ was not good. Because Jesus Christ was a convicted criminal. He wouldn't be eligible to vote for Democrats or Republicans. Even though both parties pretend like Jesus would be down with them, he was a criminal who got the death penalty. You know, and we don't allow criminals on death row to vote in U.S. elections. So I'm just saying, I think that the real Christians are the ones out here on a global corporate crusade, you know, commanding drone bombs, at the helms of fleets, onward Christian soldiers. I think they're the real Christians. And you Christians who try to pretend like you turn the other cheek, y'all not the real Christians. Y'all not interpreting that right. But it's all, I guess, interpretation, because no God has come down and said, hey, these are the ones, these ain't the ones. Like I said, even till I tell my spiritualist brothers and sisters, every religious and spiritual person will tell you, just before you got here, just before you were born, just before you came into existence, there was all this magic, all these wonderful things. And down the line, not today, maybe not tomorrow, but somewhere down the line, there's going to be all these magnificent, magical things. But right now, no magic. But in order for you to benefit from the past magic and participate in the future magic, you got to believe in those magics, even though there's no evidence of them. Whether that's walking on water or the alignment of the planet, age of Aquarius, and the return of the Sirius dog planet. The constellations align in the sky. Whatever is going to be magic one day, and there was magic back in the day, but no magic now. And anybody's telling you, hey, there's some magic that I believe in, and they don't have a dim. I mean, come on. But, hey, they're more successful than me. But you have to admit, why so many people believe? Why so many people this? The only reason there are so many believers is because the same reason there's so many patriotic Americans. I mean, it's not that complex. If I could get a bunch of maniacs to follow me around and we knock on people's door and say, hey, we're on a vegan crusade. Do you accept the light of veganism into your heart and into your gullet? And if you say yes, we move on to the next house. If you say no, we cut your tongue out. Guess what? The percentage of vegans in society would go up exponentially. And then they're going to go and say, hey, tell their children, hey, you better go vegan. Because them crazy ass vegans will cut your tongue out if you don't become a vegan. And then I could go about the world, look, you want to criticize veganism. If veganism was so bad, why are so many people accepting the vegan diet? And then after a while, the people who told their kids, hey, watch out. You bet them vegans are crazy. So I tell you what. Go ahead and be vegan. And then they tell their grandchildren, better be vegan. You don't want your tongue cut out. And then they tell their grand. After a few generations, people will be like, hey, I'm vegan because I believe. These are my personal beliefs and blah, blah, blah. And they don't understand that my ancestors were threatened, harassed, forced into this nonsense. And now, not that veganism is nonsense. And if I had that power, I probably would exercise. Maybe not cut out tongues. That's a bit extreme. But there'd be some other sanctions. But that's how there are so many Christians, Muslims, all over the world. It's not the good word, it's the saber. But what do vegans do? What do atheists do? I just got word. I have evidence. I have rationale. I'm willing to discuss it with you. So I'm not going to go with the group that wants to discuss and give evidence. I'm going to go with the group that's threatening to cut my throat and rape my daughter. I'm going to go ahead and get on their program and tell me a religion that didn't do it. And I can get your own books that you follow and show you where that was done. Or where that was advocated. I can show you in your books where it was advocated that it be done. And I can show you in history where it was actually done. And that's why the religions that didn't say, hey, follow my God or we cut out your tongue, are limited to the regions where they were created. Yoruba, Akan, Okulunkugu, all of these gods, the Janissaries, people, all of these people who follow gods that didn't tell them to go forth and spread the gospel are pretty much regional religion. And yes, some people start to, but Buddhism, imperialist, Hinduism, imperialist, Christian, and then the three Abrahamic religions were all imperialist, and they crossed multiple borders and they crossed multiple continents. And it ain't because of the light of the Lord. It ain't because of the wonderful story. It's all of the religions that made it out of their particular region, made it out of the particular tribe or the particular little delusional cult that invented this nonsense. All of them that went beyond that at the point of a sword or the point of a saber or now the point of a machine gun. And there's no evidence that any people outside of even the Romans, the birthplace of Christianity was not Africa. And yes, there is some bastardized mythology, some bastardized folklore that made it into Christian dogma and Christian belief system. Yes, but that don't make it African. Cecil Rhodes went to Africa and stole a bunch of stuff from Africa. Does that make him African or does that make him a thief? And you're going to take pride in the Rhodes scholarship? and all the colonial monuments, imperial monuments that he built to the white race and to himself. We're going to take pride in Cecil Rhodes' wealth and legacy because it originated in Africa. I don't understand that logic. Now, we understand that with imperialism, we don't look at the wealth of Europe and say, well, that wealth of Europe came from Africa. All the gold in Europe, there are vaults all over Europe full of gold. There are artifacts, African scrolls all over Europe. That's Africa. They got it from Africa. We don't take pride in that. That's a shame. That's a loss. That's a deficit. But when we say, well, Christianity started in Africa. The hell it did. No, it did not. Nor did Islam. Nor did Judaism. Sorry to say. When you look at the core of those religions, those vicious gods, Africans didn't have gods that, you know, demanded blood sacrifices. That's just not our aesthetic. But yes, all of those religions, because if you look at the era, you know, the Nile Valley, that was a superhighway. I mean, white folks like to pretend like they invented globalization and world markets. Again, another thing that they stole and corrupted. So I don't want, because if I say that, well, what? Africans had global markets? They had regional and transcontinental trade? What? Currency? Investment? Markets? Entrepreneurship started, and then y'all gonna want to run and be capitalists. Just like y'all mess stuff up. Stop taking a bastardized version of what your people had. So that's the same reason black people used to be capitalists. Markets, the first markets started in Africa. The wealthiest man who ever existed was Mansa Musa. So, I mean, they say history is supposed to enlighten us, but a lot of times it gives us justification for our lunacy. Market started in Africa, therefore capitalism started in Africa, therefore black people should be capitalists. Nope. You take one nugget of information and you make these gigantic, irrelevant leaps. Christianity started, monotheism started in Africa. Those aren't African religions, even though they have contaminated aspects of African folklore and mythology and dogma. But anyway, my larger point is, I'm sorry, it is St. Valentine's Day, and I know y'all like to take the saint out of Valentine. But this is not only a Christian holiday, it's a Roman holiday. Therefore, and it's a romantic holiday. And the word romantic, which I must impress on the community again, when you say with the suffix IC, romantic, gigantic, means of or about. So romantic means of Rome, about Rome. Right? So reason why romance novels, romance movies, romantic gestures, the reason why the Romans, even though, which is crazy, the average white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, the Western, Northwestern white, Western Europe, they don't like the Romans. I'm sorry, they don't like the Italians. They're too swarthy. If you don't know what the word swarthy means, look it up. And can I tell y'all something? And the reason we're getting into this, and I'm going to go. Romanticism. I'm going to get into that. But the reason I'm doing this is because last year on Valentine's Day, I had promised to fix people's relationships. And if you weren't currently in a loving relationship, what I had promised was I'd guide you towards getting into a relationship so that this year, the following year, you can call me to fix it. Because I know you would have messed up whatever I put together for you. So I opened up the phones and nobody wanted my love advice. Nobody wanted me to fix their lives. You know. Because I was going to come with some rational. I wasn't going to come with no pseudo-scientific, spiritualist mumbo-jumbo like Eliana Van Zandt. I was going to give you hard logic. The ugly truth. I don't think the truth is ugly. It's painful. But it ain't ugly. Ain't nothing ugly about the truth. But anyways, that offer is still on the table. But it hurt me that nobody wanted to, take me up on that offer. I thought it was a generous offer. And I am speaking from a point of experience. I don't give financial advice because I'm poor. I don't give self-defense tips because I don't feel that I'm qualified. Like, I see them cats on YouTube. They'll have somebody hold a gun at them, and then they disarm the gun. And they have somebody hold a knife there, stand there with the knife like this, and then they'll disarm the man. I don't make those videos. I ain't saying somebody come at me with a gun or knife, I'm going to do what I got to do. But the best thing I could tell you in terms of my advice to you, do what you, first of all, step one, avoid such situations. That's Diallo's self-defense tip. Number one, avoid such situations. But if such situations prove unavoidable, or if you're the type of person where your lifestyle, line of work inevitably leads to such situations, arm thyself. Know thyself, arm thyself. Step three, do what you got to do to come through. Make it. You know, that's it. So I don't give much self-defense. So there's things, if I don't know about something, I don't talk about computers. Y'all listen to, I mean, my frequent listeners to the Bro Diallo show. No damn well, I got no business talking about computers. Y'all hear me glitching out on this show, pushing the wrong buttons. Y'all hear me struggling on the show. Should call this the struggle show. So just be known, if I'm giving insights on something, it's because I'm confident that I know. Because that's the trick. That's the trick. Only talk about what you know and shut up and listen when people are talking about things you know less about. And don't let your ego get in the way. I've walked into many of rooms and just listen and observe and learn and ask questions. And I only, once I'm confident on a matter, then I start to speak upon it. So I'm just saying, just know, but if I say, hey, holla at your boy, I can get you together, it's because I can. If you want to call in here and say, I got beef in these streets, then I'll be like, hey, avoid those streets, avoid those individuals in the streets, arm yourself, and then do what you got to do. That's all. That's not the best advice. But hey, that's what happens when you come to a person who doesn't really have any special insights. I don't know how to karate a gun out of somebody's hand or karate a knife out of somebody's hand. Go to YouTube for that. See, that's bad advice right there. I shouldn't even be speaking on the issue. But it's still funny. I remember I was at King Dita one time, and he was pulling up all these YouTube videos of these guys giving these advice. And I think dudes should be liable. There was some capoeira crazy dude who had somebody literally put a gun to his head and telling people they could survive such a scenario if they do step one, cha-cha-cha. I'm like, come on, man. Stop it. I mean, why don't you got the camera, you got the fake gun, you got the karate moves. Make a little action movie or something. Don't try to make informative. Make, just entertain us, man. Stop it. People trying to take this stuff too real. And I know this Black Panther stuff going to have all y'all thinking y'all can do scratchy karate. Y'all going to get some metallic fingernails and get out here and start scratching each other. I mean, it's just it's fiction. Come on. Let's enjoy the fiction, but come on. And don't be out here trying to scratch me. But anyway, the offer stands on this St. Valentine's Day. Feel free to call me if you want me to fix it. If you are with somebody and you want to get that man together, if you want to get that woman together, call me. I can tell you how. If you are alone and want somebody, I can tell you how to get somebody. If you got too much. You got too many men sniffing in behind you. You got so many women, you're just exhausted trying to service all these women. And you want to repulse some of those women. You want to disgust those women. You want to drive those women away. I can get you there. Some of us got too much love. That's the problem. It's an imbalance. Some of us got too much love. And if you want to redistribute some of your women around, you want to redistribute some of your men to some of these sisters who ain't got nobody, I can help you to do that. But I will not do it with emotion, with heart, with feeling. I will do it with pure rationality. The root of any successful human connection is has to be a rational connection. And all of the emotion, all of the feelings, but again, let me go back to romantic and what romantic means, right? Now, St. Valentine, anyway, was a real dude from 3rd century Rome, and blah, blah, blah. But here, let me tell you, when white people say romantic, and we all, when black people say romantic, what that means is related to or of Rome. The reason why white people say related to or of Rome is because that is the basis in white people's imagination of their culture, civilization, and empire. Roman philosophy, Roman architecture, Roman government, and the Roman democracy, the Roman forum, intellectual, cultural, philosophical, architectural foundations of Western society. They say that the kings of Europe are all descendants of Roman emperors. The German, the French, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the British, even the Nordic regions, it all sprung from Rome. So Rome is not only the origins, it was the pinnacle. And every single, the British Empire seeks to replicate what Rome did. The Germans, even Hitler. Hitler went to Rome and Mussolini. He didn't like Mussolini as a person, but he respected Mussolini as the protector of the purity of Rome. So when white folks say romantic, they not just talking about flowers, chocolates, and foot massages. They are talking about the very germ seed, the very foundation of their global empire, of their power, of their wealth, of their very self-perception. Now, there's a contradiction there because these same people who grew out of Rome despise the Italians. They call them swarthy. They think that they've contaminated their culture. Because Italy is a peninsula and it juts out into, what's that body of water called? I was just going over there with my son. Anyway, basically, North Africa. You can literally throw a stone from the northern tip of Egypt onto the southern tip of Sicily, the island of Sicily. And the island of Sicily is just a hop, skip, and a jump, as they used to say, from the Roman mainland, the Italian mainland. And there was a lot of cross-contamination. We all know about Hannibal and all that, and the elephants coming across the Alps. We all know about Roman incursions into North Africa and eventually establishing some. We all know about Caesar, Cleopatra. We all know that. We all know those wonderful romantic stories. But white people say yes. The Romans built their empire just like everyone else, stealing resources from Africa, stealing not just physical material resources, but intellectual resources from Africa. You go look at the Doric and what do they call the other columns? I think Ionic or Iconic columns and the Doric columns, straight out of Africa. You look at the sculptures, you know, and you go look at the Egyptian sculpture, which are tens of thousands of years older than the Roman sculpture. So there's a love-hate relationship, which we all know. There's a lot of, like, movies and jokes and memes about white folks and their parents. And a lot of black kids, especially in the Vine era, that show how white kids talk to their parents versus how black kids talk to their parents. How black people are in fear, in awe. There's a tradition of respecting elders in African culture, whereas there's a tradition of abandoning elders and to stew in their own waste in nursing homes. And there's a this idea of always new, always advancing, always modernizing. Whereas Africa, there's more of a tradition of Sankofa, looking back, reverence for the past in order to move forward. Ah, somebody want me to fix their life. Hello, caller. You're on the Bro Diallo show. State your name or alias and where you're calling from.
Good morning, brother. This is the Prince of Pan-Africanism calling, brother, for your love advice this morning.
Oh, yeah, brother. I've been hoping you call. What's up, Big Papa? You want to go back to the first two baby mamas or you moving towards the third baby mama? I could get you either direction.
Well, brother, I'm trying to be like you, brother. I'm trying to finally settle down, brother, and get married and raise my kids. Stay out of these courts, my brother, and I've humbled myself. You know, the Prince of Pan-Africanism is tired of being in these child support streets. So I went on a little angry rant the other day about one of my baby's mamas making a post that it didn't speak to me directly, but it indirectly was kind of trashing me about me complaining about having to go to court. And thing about it is, one of my women's that I'm interested in, she got a little put off by that post. I want to know how I can repair things with my new girl that I'm trying to get with, you know, I just want to know what I could do or say to make her feel like, you know, that I would be responsible if she were to get impregnated by the Prince of Pan-Africanism. And secondly, I'd like you to also address an article that you posted, my brother, the other day about the Washington Post article about the number of black men in prison decreasing and the whites increasing. I want to know, what do you think spurred this on, or what's behind that? And I just want to thank you for giving the Prince of Pan-Africanism this good advice that I know you're going to give, and I appreciate all the work that you do. I just ask that you stop talking about my hats, brother. Peace be upon
you. Thank you, brother. I am greatly honored. Thank you, and I will answer the question on how you can fix the past baby mamas and the current pursuit of your love, the woman you've deemed worthy enough of your love. So,
and don't forget the Washington Post piece, my brother. Yeah, you know, the Prince of Pan-Africanism need that knowledge.
All right, brother.
The Prince of Pan-Africanism need that knowledge. All right, my brother.
All right, Big
peace,
Papa.
Peace be unto you, brother.
All right, Big Papa. All right. Let's deal with Big Papa's first issue, the baby mama drama. Now, I'm going to tell you, Big Papa, it starts with you, and I know you know that. You are the man. You are the central. You are the fulcrum. You are at the throne. You are, like you said, you are at the head of the household, that where the black man needs to be. But here's your number one problem, Big Papa, why things ain't lining up for you. You're existing in two contradictory realms. Number one, you want to be African. Number two, now in your persona, in your ideology, in your mission, you say you're Pan-African. But in your operations, in your function, day-to-day function, and in your fundamental mentality, you are a fundamentalist Christian. Fundamentalist Christianity is the basis of your Pan-Africanism. And that's why nothing seems to come together and stay together for you. You want to be, all of the ideas that you have fit cozy. So you have to make a decision. Do you want to be Pan-African, or do you want to be evangelical, right-wing, conservative Christian? Because you can't marry these two. And so since your ideology and your what you advocate for doesn't come together, your personal relationships will suffer from that same contradictory chaos. And I know this is unfortunate. So if you want women that will submit to you and be docile, you can't also infuse them with Pan-African ideology and rhetoric. So what you will have to do is pick a side. So if you pick the evangelical side, then you will start to move among spaces where women who have been heavily indoctrinated to believe that a woman is a helpmeet that came from the rib of Adam and has an eternity of sin to atone for Eve departing from God's will and being seduced by the serpent, eating of the tree of knowledge, giving that, and then seducing Adam to eat that fruit, thus damning man, thus her menstruation and her childbirth are eternal curses. And all, you need women who were raised up in that and have been implanted with that and who have embraced that. And so if you come out as a true and say, hey, this African stuff is just a cover, in my heart of heart, I am an evangelical Christian. I am a fundamentalist evangelical Christian in my ideology and in the way I view women and the type of society I want to establish for Africans, with a man at the head of the household and a wife who is a subordinate wife and obedient children and no gays, no single mothers, and no shenanigans. And that can still allow you to pursue strippers and do your other things and Japanese hot tubs, because again, in the fundamentalist ideology, it is embedded in there to saying that man will fall short of the glory of God. And then they have the whole thing, confess your sins to Jesus, like, you know, Jerry Falwell and Jimmy Swagger, I have sinned before you. And you come and confess your sins, and then you start all over again on the sin bus. So it's a wonderful ideology. If you are a sexist man who wants to dominate women, and wants to be, and not only dominate women, but to justifiably harass, condemn, and even torture and kill people who behave in ways that you are not with, it's evangelical. So go ahead and say, listen, I have found Jesus Christ as my Lord and Savior. All this Africa stuff is of the devil. They demonic African gods and voodoo. Go ahead, and people will embrace it. Get up there with T.D. Jakes, Creflo Dollar, then you'll have the money. You don't even have to hustle for schools. You don't have to pretend. Replace the school fund with a church fund. Same, you're running a Christian hustle under the veil. Just rip off that kente cloth, rip off that mud cloth, shake off those cowrie shells, and you will be in your right space. You will have private jets to go to Asia to sit in hot tubs to make your YouTube videos. So step one, and even your two baby mamas, you will have all the Christians say, this is a good Christian man, and y'all trying to bring them down, you Jezebels. So you don't even have to fight with them. Your very ideology and all of the followers of your faith, of your Christian faith, will attack them for you. You can just step back and let them do. So that's step if number one. Stop playing African and go ahead and be the evangelical, ultra-conservative Christian that you are. And it doesn't take much. You got to throw away just a little bit of your anti-white rhetoric. Throw away just a little bit of your African rhetoric and just everything else. You won't even notice the difference. You already got that thick neck and stuffy suit look of a Black Baptist preacher anyway. You already got the look. You just got to tweak the rhetoric. And I'm telling you, you go up in one of these temples and you find yourself a prophetess, and she will know in her heart, I must submit to my man. I must obey my man, and I must reproduce and multiply for my man. And my ambition, I can't even speak. In the Christian doctrine, women aren't even allowed to speak. They must speak through their husband. It works perfectly. Step one. Or step two, you can become an actual Pan-Africanist. But if you're going to be an actual Pan-Africanist and you're looking for love from a Pan-Africanist, conscious, revolutionary woman, then you're going to have a partnership. You're going to have to hear her assert her will, her ideas, her thoughts, and then you're going to have to communicate your positions, and then you're going to have to cooperate. It's a little harder. I grant it. It's going to be a little harder, but the ultimate reward is better. Because if you go the evangelical route, you won't really have a compliment. And what's going to happen is you're going to go further and deeper into your delusions, because you won't have a woman that is in the position where she can rightfully say, what the hell are you doing, and what the hell is wrong with you? Get it together. Whereas on the Pan-African side, the women aren't equal to men. It's not a competition. It's not about tit for tat. But the women exist in their own space and have as much authority amongst themselves. They have full agency. And there's really no doctrine. There's no religion. There are no gods to give us agency over women. Women have their own agencies. Therefore, you must negotiate with them. You must cooperate with them. Which is harder. But if you're going to get Pan-Africanist, you have to get rid of this head of household nonsense. And I know that's hard for a lot of brothers who came up, you know, because when we came off the plantation, our idea was, hey, I'm going to run my household the way the white man runs his household. What other examples did we have? It wasn't like after slavery, they found the smartest slaves on each plantation and gave them a study grant to go back to Africa and rediscover our traditional ways prior to our enslavement. So when we came off the plantation, most of us, black men and women, the best thing we could figure out to do is mimic what white folks are doing. That's it. And I know black men love to talk about how black women mimic white women. Like your blonde contacts and your blonde wigs and your straighten your hair and extension. But we never really have discussions on how black men mimic white men. And our mimicry of black men, of white men, is so detrimental to the larger community. It's not just about the financial drain. It's about the utter existential threat to the survivability of our race. And yes, abandoning children and hating child support is a white thing. That's not black. There were no orphanages, no poorhouses, no feed houses. White men set it off. They originated the very concept of baby daddy and even gangsterism. So that's all I'm saying. Stop with the, if you end your internal conflicts and contradictions, then your interpersonal and romantic conflicts and contradictions will dissipate as well. I promise you. That's my fix for Dr. Umar and a lot of other so-called militant conscious brothers who can't get no good woman. You can't be in your interpersonal relationships, in your intimate relationships, a evangelical Christian man at the head of the household, and then in your revolutionary, I want to liberate the people. You can't liberate the people while trying to oppress in the bedroom or in the kitchen. And I know, and I know that it's hard because black men want to live up to this Rambo, macho man image that we imitate from white folks. But, you know, and it goes back. I have to go and dig this book out. You know, it's really interesting. I read African history. But something I started doing, which I had stopped doing for a time, but I started doing again in recent years, is reading African history by European historians. And once you read African history from African historians, so when you, first, you got to have a groundings. But then when you return, after you then got Ivan Van Sertimer, Dr. Bend, and all that, you got that. Return, and you'll start to see white folks telling truths as a result of double lies. It's just interesting, but I'm going to have to bring the book in. But the book I'm referring to talks about how European men, from the day they landed on Africa's shores, were mocking black men for being too effeminate, not having control of our women. This is before they first docked the first and built the first, you know, fort or slave fort on Africa. This is back when they were just exploring, just trying to figure out what they wanted to do or how to go about doing. They always knew what they wanted to do because they do it to themselves. Slave, rape, pillage. But back when they were still pretending to be just humble explorers, you know, eager traders before enslavement, colonization. That even then, in their most early writings about African society, they called black men effeminate and said we didn't have proper control of our women. And they even mocked the kings. They said the kings didn't have proper rule. There's the peasants. Now, there were no kings. There were no peasants because we didn't speak that language. That wasn't our word for it. But what they had to put whatever they saw happening in Africa in within their own eyes. If I went to an alien civilization, the first thing I would do as an earthling is say, where are the different nations? And if I see people interacting, but they look different, I might say, hey, they're green aliens and blue aliens. They must be two different races. And there's aliens on this part of the planet, and they must be separate nations. And I see some aliens with, you know, protrusions on their chest. Those might be the females, and those are the males. The ones without the protrusions on their chest. It's like maybe the taller ones, the larger aliens might be the aggressors. And the small aliens might be dominated by the taller aliens. or if they chose to, I'm going to put everything I see within the context of my own experience. There's no other way for me to interpret it. Now, there might be no gender separation or gender dysmorphia, or there might be 1,000 different genders. There could be anything, but that's, I can't, until I've had some time, understand it. So I have to interpret it my own way. If I see the aliens exchanging, you know, things for goods and services, well, that must be a market. That must be their currency. I'm going to start naming things what I know the names and trying to reinterpret what they're doing in a way that is perceptible by me, even though I could be dead ass wrong. I could be dead ass wrong. And I could see them walking with one alien on their shoulders, and he has the best clothing and adorned, he or she or whatever it is, adorned, and all the other aliens are bowing down before it. And I could say, wow, that must be the king of the aliens. And then I see them and they go dump him in a volcano. Like, oh, well, that was a sacrifice. But from the looks of things, the way everybody was honoring him, I thought he ruled them, but actually he was a tool being used by them. You know, who knows? If I see them walking up, bowing to a rock, I mean, like, that must be their religion or their God. They might not have any type of religion or no concept of religion. So when people encounter something that's strange, they try to put it in the context that they understand. You know, that's it. And even things that we've studied for hundreds of years, like a lion pride. Oh, the male lion rules over the female lions. He's the king. Or the bull elephant is the aggressor. He's the bull, and he fights off all the other male elephants. He must run teams. And just now, in the last 3 or 4 years, after all this research and science, they're finding, oh, lions, wolves, hyenas, those are more matriarchal. Or even the alpha wolf, they don't have a hierarchical rulership. Like, this wolf makes the decision to tell all the other wolves what they can and can't do. But that's how our societies are structured. So that's the only thing we understand. So even lions, creatures that don't even have a governance, who don't even have a hierarchy. That's how we interpret it. You know, they saw two male penguins giving each other companionship. Oh, look at the gay penguins. And wrote a book about gay penguins. And the penguins are like, what? Gay? Homosexuality? What the hell are you talking about? We're not heterosexual or homosexual. We only breed according to cycles and environmental and hormonal provocations. Our relationships are not intimate. You know, this is nature. Yeah. And so, but that's all I'm saying. So when they went to Africa, they saw a lot of things they did not understand. They saw some people providing services to other people, and there was no exchange of currency. So the Europeans said, those are slaves. And then some Europeans say, well, they're slaves in name only. They don't seem to be beaten. They don't seem to be harassed. They seem to act more out of obligation and concern more so than coercion and exploitation. So they must be slaves, because what else could they be? What is another person providing services to another person with no exchange of currency? No wages. So it must be a slave, but they would call them slaves in name only because they didn't endure any of the atrocities or dehumanizing treatment. And then they come back, they take a boat trip back and come back a few years later, and the person they called a slave is now governing the community, is now a respected elder in the community. And they was like, oh, he must have been liberated somehow. They didn't know it could have been an apprenticeship, but they didn't know. Because in European culture, look it up, an apprentice had to perform sexual favors. Mentor. Go look up the ancient meaning and the ancient relationship of a mentor and a mentee. So if I am teaching and cultivating a young man, then that young man must provide, by default, sexual favors for me. That's their concept. It's like if I see a young man or a group of young men serving an older man or older men, then, and there's no sexual exchange, then that can't be a mentorship. That can't be an apprenticeship. That must be slavery. And then we have sex with our slaves too, but it's not necessarily written in the contract. That's something you do in the dark. You creep. So that's all I'm saying. And because, like I said, when we got off the plantation, they didn't send any scholars to go back and research. So many of our behaviors are just that we picked up from our ancestors are just us trying to mimic. Like white people when we came off the plantation, have a level of power and a level of comfort and a level of resources, and they're smart. They seem smart to us because we were forced into our ignorance. We couldn't read. So you just see a white kid write their name like, wow, what brilliance. So a lot of things we did, we just mimicked white folks. We set up households. We tried to farm the land, the technology, the pursuits, the interests, the values, the goals. And that was the whole point of the Afrocentricity movement, is to get away from these corrupting values. We found out we did it for over, 200 years. Say, okay, we're going to do some Leave It to Beaver stuff. Even though we didn't have the resources to Leave It to Beaver, we tried to Leave It to Beaver. And our beaver ended up being roadkill. So it's like, well, instead of trying to replicate what they do, how about, based on our experiences in the so-called New World, based on our ancient teachings, based on contemporary African, how Africa, because Africa didn't stop. Africa continued to evolve. So the Africa we left is not the Africa of today, but it grew out of that Africa that we left. So just as, so we say, hey, we're going to take ancient teachings, modern contemporary practices, our experiences here, and our unique understanding and history, and we're going to try to melt that into something that works for us, that diverges from what they do and what we've been doing. Makes sense. And it's an imperfect process, but I'm glad the work is happening. Anyway, that's all I'm saying. A lot of these black militants are nothing more than evangelical Christians wrapped in kente cloth. And I don't blame Garvey 100 years ago saying, I'm a Christian capitalist. But what's your excuse? Garvey is like, hey, it's 100 years ago. All I've ever seen is industrial capitalism. Garvey never went to Africa. And books and teachings, he didn't have Yorugu. He didn't have the philosophies and opinions of Garvey to learn from. He was in the process of writing that. So we don't mimic or repeat what our ancestors did. We build on it. We expand it. We improve it. We refine it. Whatever. That's number one, Big Papa. Number two, several major news outlets picked up on this story. There's been a big decline in the black incarceration rate, and almost nobody's paying attention. Now, all this good black news, all this good black news, lowest unemployment rate since they started keeping statistics. And now, a big decline. A big decline in incarceration rates. Now, incarceration rates of white women is going up, and incarceration rates of black women is going down. And even throughout the decline between 2000 and 2014, right, black women still have a double incarceration rate. It went from quadruple the incarceration rates of white women to just double. And what did Malcolm X say? When you stick the knife in my damn back and you pull it out halfway, this is not a time of jubilation. You understand? Now, black men, and they do this by the number of inmates per 1,000 people. For every 100,000 black people in the United States, how many of those 100,000 are currently in prison? For white women, who's skyrocketing incarceration rate? Oh, black white women. Oh, poor. Oh, sing. They need to learn. Y'all sisters, go teach these white women some Negro doctrines and teach them how to snap them peas so they can sit there and rock back and forth on their porch and sing them songs and snap them peas, because they're now white women are suffering. Oh, me too. Hashtag. Oh, time's up. White woman. Oh, my God. For every 100,000 white women in the U.S. population, for every 100,000 white women, there's 53 white women in prison. Oh, oh, I swoon, white woman. For black women, for every 100,000 black women in prison, 109, double, more than double the rate of incarceration. And this is current. This is the drop. Now, for black women, it's gone down by half. Right? And for white women, it's increased by what? 12%? And my wife, who is a researcher, who is a community psychologist, is currently working on and researching. Now, black women incarceration. Now, let me give you the accurate numbers. Black women incarceration has gone down by 22%, which is, no, why aren't we talking about this? This is something they want us to do, the Holy Ghost dance. This is something they want us to thank them for, when it should be down 100%. This is something they want us to thank them for, and I guess we're going to thank them for it. So let's go on and thank the 22% when we had no business being locked up in there. But 22%? Thank you, white man. Thank you, white man. Out of jail. 22%. Thank you, white man. Okay. And at the exact same MFing time, white women increase 4% in the last decade, more than a decade, in the last decade. Now, the reason why you can have a 22% decline, and that's no different than saying the black community's wealth has increased in the last year by $5 billion, collective wealth. But since we had a negative wealth, it's not as big. This is some bull. This is nothing to celebrate, but I know I'm messing with y'all Valentine's Day. I know y'all spreading rose petals on your mattresses, even you militants. I know y'all got y'all chocolates, even you vegans got your fair trade carob, fair trade dairy free chocolates, sugar free chocolates, horrible rancid brown chalk. I know you got your scented oils. Edible undies. I know you brothers in there doing extra push-ups and sit-ups this morning. I know y'all getting ready for something, but I'm just throwing salt in everybody's game. But this is some boo. This is nothing to celebrate. This is something we should observe. This is something we should work on. But it's nothing to do the Holy Ghost dance. A 22% drop in black women's incarceration, a 4% rise, and black women's incarceration is still more than double white women. Right? It's worse for white men. It's worse for us. For every 100,000 black men in this society, 2,724 are still incarcerated. And that's a decline in the last decade and a half. In the year 2000, coming into the year 2000, for every 100,000 black men, 3,457 were incarcerated. And that's gone down to 2,700. Now, white men have skyrocketed. White men are now, in 2000, for every 100,000 white men, there were 449 449 of white men in prison. 2014, the last time they got these stats, for every, now, I mean, I'm shuddering. We got to teach white boys some Negro spirituals, get them some broke iron boots, buy some white, show white men where we pick up them rusty dust covered overalls and get them a pickaxe and send them to the rail yard. So they, white men. For every 100,000 white men in the year 2014, this is the skyrocketing, this is the increase, because that article said the incarceration rates are dropping for blacks and going up for whites. So for every 100,000 white men incarcerated, there's 465. It's gone up in the last 14 years. From 449 per 100,000 to 465 per 1,000. So black men, we did receive a decline from the artificially elevated rates of incarceration. We did. But y'all want to do the Holy Ghost dance? I know I just gave y'all these statistics. And black men? Or what? I need to start bringing, open up the calculator app. What's the difference between how many times does 465 go into 2,724? How many times? It's more than double, more than triple, more than quadruple. But y'all want to celebrate this? Let me give y'all music. Go on, dance. Go on and dance. Go ahead. Now let's get it out. Get it out. Go ahead. Woo! I'm starting to feel it myself now. Done? You got it out? Is the celebration over? Oh, Black Panther coming out day after tomorrow. Might as well get that out of the way. Lowest jobless rates ever recorded for black people. Oh, but when they reevaluated the numbers, they found out in about a month, the numbers went back to normal. So it was a statistical error, but whatever. We celebrate in fiction nowadays as reality. And we got a petition. We want 25% of the profits generated by the Black Panther movie to be invested in the black community, whatever the hell that means. Come on. You done? You done? Are y'all done? Done celebrating? Now, I don't know. You can get this anywhere. Black incarceration rate decline. But one of the best articles is the Washington Post, which is a conservative article. So, you know, they ain't going to try to ham it up. They ain't going to try to ham it up. But here's the thing. This decline in black incarceration rate was already predicted to go in concert with the decline in black birth rates. 20, 30 years ago, they already knew we're going to have to lock up more crackers because we're going to have fewer niggers to lock up. This was already a trend that they had predicted in their think tank from the Heritage Foundation. The Bilderberg meetings, they already knew. They had already deliberately worked to decline the black presence in overall society. So the black lower incarceration and lower unemployment rate is because we are being purged from society. And one way to purge someone from society is to kill them. But there are other ways. You got to go read the Convention on Genocide. How we under, just like we are oppressed for generations and we don't have any working definition and understanding of oppression. We don't have oppression conferences. And we even shame the very notion of people who acknowledge that we are under genocide or oppression. Oh, you're victim blaming. And genocide. We should have oppression genocide conferences annually studying it. The history of it, the methodologies, the tools and instruments and technology of oppression and genocide. Speaking of which, I mean, I might have to put that out. Y'all want to come together, black engineers, black lawyers, black doctors and scientists. And y'all want to ignore the fact that the black engineers are building and designing supermax prisons. The black lawyers are sitting on the benches convicting and locking us up, or serving as prosecutors, or writing down the laws and the public policies to further oppress us. You want to ignore that and just celebrate. The black engineers are designing the weapon systems and the biochemical weapons and the drone guidance systems and the missile guidance systems. all that STEM. We want to celebrate. But you got to look at the larger social implications. I just said to y'all right now, you could get a degree in high science. You could get a PhD in computer science without having to take one freaking class in ethics. You don't have to take a full class in nutrition, and you could become a physician cutting people open or telling people how to stay healthy or cure disease, and you don't know anything about how to feed, nourish, and sustain the body. So yes, incarceration rates for white people are going up, but for decades, if not centuries, they've been held artificially low because of the system, institutions, and practices of global white domination. Black people is coming down, but it's been artificially high for those same reasons. But it is not a full-on correction because white people have predicted and published peer-reviewed articles saying that the black population, if all social indicators hold steady in terms of labor, employment, homicide, incarceration, the advent of technology, globalization, outsourcing, if all of these social indicators hold steady, we can predict a perceptible decline in the overall black population. And then the few black people who remain, a large percentage of them will be drug addicted or too damn insane or will permanently exit the dominant economy because there's no room for them. They got auto plants where there is literally not one worker on the floor. It's all done by machines. And now they got self-driving cars. And all these brothers, and they talk about black unemployment. These black people out here in the gig economy, they're not employees. They're free agents. They are their own CEOs. And their little car and their driver's seat is the boardroom. And the back alley they have to piss in is, you know, the executive's bathroom. I don't know how it breaks down. So these quote-unquote positive statistics have some very insidious underlying implications. If you meet somebody and they were 75 pounds underweight and you see them the next day and they lost 100 pounds and you're like, oh, look, you're losing weight. You're getting healthy. Wonderful. Nope, I've contracted AIDS or I have metastatic colon cancer. So losing weight is not inherently good, even though the larger society might say, hey, you're losing weight, you got to be getting healthier. No, losing weight could be a sign of health or a sign of a larger disease. It could be either one. You got to look at the underlying causes. So yes, black unemployment's going down and black incarceration's going down because there ain't no more black people to tell to, ain't no more black people that we can't tear up their application and they ain't there to lock up. Can't lock up Trayvon. So even though, just before, now that we're done with the whole, like I said, celebrate when it's something worthy of celebrating, moan and bemoan when it's something that's sad. But then when the emotions are run through and the hugs are handed out and the libations are poured and the prayers are said and the incense and candles are burnt, it's time to sit down and be rational and think. I ain't saying be automatons. Yeah, let's go through the emotion, but let's give equal weight to rational solutions and rational analysis. So in terms of incarceration rate, they didn't pull the knife out halfway. And what is their motivation? So yeah, white people with their opioid epidemic, which is something I'll probably talk in depth about that. And there's some good things. Anyway, I didn't really get through my romanticism. But black people, I'm going to tell you, and I don't quote this woman often because I think she's bat guano insane. Sister Scheherazade Ali. Sister Scheherazade Ali said, we can't be romantic because we are not the Romans. And I say you can have, instead of romantic night evening, have yourself a comedic evening. Have yourself a dogonic evening. Have yourself a Eurobic evening. Have yourself a Zuluic evening. Just pick any civilization that you are in awe of and put IC at the end of it. Ashantic evening. And let that be your perception of the height of human development or the root of human development. whatever you want to call it. But we need to stop playing this romantic mess. It don't even work for white folks. So how the hell could something that they invented for themselves that don't even work too well for them, you know, gonna work for us? That's all I'm saying. But today is also the birthday of Frederick Douglass. Also, a few days ago was the 110th anniversary of the founding of the NAACP. And every year at this time, I love to play Dr. William Mackey's The History and Portrayal of the NAACP. But I'd be remiss not to play at least some readings or words of the great Frederick Douglass, whom, if you know about Negro History Week, which evolved into Black History Month, which I don't celebrate, but, you know, more power to you. The fact that Frederick Douglass' birthday fell on February was a big influence because Carter G. Woodson greatly respected and admired Frederick Douglass, as do I. One of our greatest ancestors and lesser son. I mean, but I can't even say he didn't get his props, because Frederick Douglass, up until Martin Luther the King came on the scene, I would probably say Frederick Douglass and who's the Tuskegee dude? Booker T. Washington were the two most recognized and revered Black men in the Black community. It was Frederick Douglass. And then, you know, they were later overshadowed. But Frederick Douglass is an icon of our race. And our struggle for humanity and liberation. So I'm going to play some readings of his word, What the Negro Wants, an 1865 speech. And I'd like to wish a happy birthday to Frederick Douglass and also the NAACP. I see that they're trying to, you know, working with the Moral Mondays and getting with the Urban League to expand their mandate. But I mean, I think it's a dinosaur and it needs to be put out to pasture. But, you know, Black Lives Matter pretty much is taking all the plays from their book anyway. A playbook that has failed us thus far. But NAACP it was founded in 1908 on February 12th. Frederick Douglass, born February 14th in 1817. So congratulations to him. And I will be back after we hear some words written and spoken by our great ancestors and that are preserved to this day.
What the Black Man Wants by Frederick Douglass, delivered at the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, 1865. I came here, as I always come to the meetings in New England, as a listener and not as a speaker, and one of the reasons why I have not been more frequently to the meetings of this society has been because of the disposition on the part of some of my friends to call me out upon the platform, even when they knew that there was some difference of opinion and of feeling between those who rightfully belong to this platform and myself. And for fear of being misconstrued as desiring to interrupt or disturb the proceedings of these meetings, I have usually kept away, and have thus been deprived of that educating influence which I am always free to confess is of the highest order descending from this platform. I have felt, since I have lived out west, that in going there I parted from a great deal that was valuable, and I feel, every time I come to these meetings, that I have lost a great deal by making my home west of Boston, west of Massachusetts. For if anywhere in the country there is to be found the highest sense of justice, or the truest demands for my race, I look for it in the East. I look for it here. The ablest discussions of the whole question of our rights occur here. And to be deprived of the privilege of listening to those discussions is a great deprivation. I do not know, from what has been said, that there is any difference of opinion as to the duty of abolitionists at the present moment. How can we get up any difference at this point, or any point, where we are so united, so agreed? I went especially, however, with that word of Mr. Phillips, which is the criticism of General Banks and General Banks' policy. I hold that that policy is our chief danger at the present moment, that it practically enslaves the Negro and makes the proclamation of 1863 a mockery and delusion. What is freedom? It is the right to choose one's own employment. Certainly it means that, if it means anything, and when any individual or combination of individuals undertakes to decide for any man when he shall work, where he shall work, at what he shall work, and for what he shall work, he or they practically reduce him to slavery. He is a slave. That I understand General Banks to do, to determine for the so-called freedmen when and where, and at what, and for how much he shall work, when he shall be punished, and by whom punished. It is absolute slavery. It defeats the beneficent intention of the government, if it has beneficent intentions, in regards to the freedom of our people. I have had but one idea for the last 3 years to present to the American people, and the phraseology in which I clothe it is the old abolition phraseology. I am for the immediate, unconditional, and universal enfranchisement of the black man in every state in the Union. Without this, his liberty is a mockery. Without this, you might as well almost retain the old name of slavery for his condition, for in fact, if he is not the slave of the individual master, he is the slave of society, and holds his liberty as a privilege, not as a right. He is at the mercy of the mob, and has no means of protecting himself. It may be objected, however, that this pressing of the Negro's right to suffrage is premature. Let us have slavery abolished, it may be said. Let us have labor organized, and then, in the natural course of events, the right of suffrage will be extended to the Negro. I do not agree with this. The constitution of the human mind is such that if it once disregards the conviction forced upon it by a revelation of truth, it requires the exercise of a higher power to produce the same conviction afterwards. The American people are now in tears. The Shenandoah has run blood, the best blood of the North. All around Richmond, the blood of New England and of the North has been shed. Of your sons, your brothers, and your fathers. We all feel in the existence of this rebellion that judgments terrible, widespread, far-reaching, overwhelming, are abroad in the land, and we feel, in view of these judgments just now, a disposition to learn righteousness. This is the hour. Our streets are in mourning. Tears are falling at every fireside. And under the chastisement of this rebellion, we have almost come up to the point of conceding this great, this all-important right of suffrage. I fear that if we fail to do it now, if abolitionists fail to press it now, we may not see, for centuries to come, the same disposition that exists at this moment. Hence I say, now is the time to press this right. It may be asked, why do you want it? Some men have got along very well without it. Women have not this right. Shall we justify one wrong by another? This is the sufficient answer. Shall we at this moment justify the deprivation of the Negro of the right to vote because someone else is deprived of that privilege? I hold that women, as well as men, have the right to vote. And my heart and voice go with the movement to extend suffrage to women. But that question rests upon another basis than which our right rests. We may be asked, I say, why we want it. I will tell you why we want it. We want it because it is our right, first of all. No class of men can, without insulting their own nature, be content with any deprivation of their rights. We want it again as a means for educating our race. Men are so constituted that they derive their conviction of their own possibilities largely by the estimate formed of them by others. If nothing is expected of a people, that people will find it difficult to contradict that expectation. By depriving us of suffrage, you affirm our incapacity to form an intelligent judgment respecting public men and public measures. You declare before the world that we are unfit to exercise the elective franchise, and by this means, lead us to undervalue ourselves, to put a low estimate upon ourselves, and to feel that we have no possibilities like other men. Again, I want the elective franchise for one as a colored man, because ours is a peculiar government, based upon a peculiar idea, and that idea is universal suffrage. If I were in a monarchical government, or an autocratic or aristocratic government, where the few bore rule and the many were subject, there would be no special stigma resting upon me because I did not exercise the elective franchise. It would do me no great violence. Mingling with the mass, I should partake of the strength of the mass. I should be supported by the mass, and I should have the same incentives to endeavor with the mass of my fellow men. It would be no particular burden, no particular deprivation. But here, where universal suffrage is the rule, where that is the fundamental idea of the government, to rule us out is to make us an exception, to brand us with the stigma of inferiority, and to invite to our heads the missiles of those about us. Therefore, I want the franchise for the black man. There are, however, other reasons, not derived from any consideration merely of our rights, but arising out of the conditions of the South and of the country, considerations which have already been referred to by Mr. Phillips, considerations which must arrest the attention of statesmen. I believe that when the tall heads of this rebellion shall have been swept down, as they will be swept down, when the Davises and Toombses and Stevenses and others who are leading this rebellion shall have been blotted out, there will be this rank undergrowth of treason, to which reference has been made, growing up there and interfering with and thwarting the quiet operation of the federal government in those states. You will see those traitors handing down, from sire to son, the same malignant spirit which they have manifested, and which they are now exhibiting, with malicious hearts, broad blades, and bloody hands in the field, against our sons and brothers. That spirit will still remain, and whoever sees the federal government extended over those southern states will see that government in a strange land, and not only in a strange land, but in an enemy's land. A postmaster of the United States in the South will find himself surrounded by a hostile spirit. A collector in a southern port will find himself surrounded by a hostile spirit. A United States Marshal or United States Judge will be surrounded there by a hostile element. That enmity will not die out in a year, will not die out in an age. The federal government will be looked upon in those states, precisely as the governments of Austria and France are looked upon in Italy at the present moment. They will endeavor to circumvent, they will endeavor to destroy, the peaceful operation of this government. Now, where will you find the strength to counterbalance this spirit if you do not find it in the Negroes of the South? They are your friends, and have always been your friends. They were your friends even when the government did not regard them as such. They comprehended the genius of this war before you did. It is a significant fact. It is a marvelous fact. It seems almost to imply a direct interposition of providence, that this war, which began in the interest of slavery on both sides, bids fair to end in the interest of liberty on both sides. It was begun, I say, in the interest of slavery on both sides. The South was fighting to take slavery out of the Union, and the North was fighting to keep it in the Union. The South fighting to get it beyond the limits of the United States Constitution, and the North fighting to retain it within those limits. The South fighting for new guarantees, and the North fighting for the old guarantees, both despising the Negro, both insulting the Negro, Yet the Negro, apparently endowed with wisdom from on high, saw more clearly the end from the beginning than we did. When Seward said the status of no man in the country would be changed by the war, the Negro did not believe him. When our generals sent their underlings in shoulder straps to hunt the flying Negro back from our lines into the jaws of slavery from which he had escaped, the Negroes thought that a mistake had been made and that the intentions of the government had not been rightly understood by our officers in shoulder straps. And they continued to come into our lines, threading their way through bogs and fens, over briars and thorns, fording streams, swimming rivers, bringing us tidings as to the safe path to march, and pointing out the dangers that threatened us. They are our only friends in the South, and we should be true to them in this their trial hour, and see to it that they have the elective franchise. I know that we are inferior to you in some things, virtually inferior. We walk about you like dwarfs among giants. Our heads are scarcely seen above the great sea of humanity. The Germans are superior to us. The Irish are superior to us. The Yankees are superior to us. They can do what we cannot, that is, what we have not hitherto been allowed to do. But while I make this admission, I utterly deny that we are originally, or naturally, or practically, or in any way, or in any important sense, inferior to anybody on this globe. This charge of inferiority is an old dodge. It has been made available for oppression on many occasions. It is only about 6 centuries since the blue-eyed and fair-haired Anglo-Saxons were considered inferior by the haughty Normans who once trampled upon them. If you read the history of the Norman conquest, you will find that this proud Anglo-Saxon was once looked upon as of coarser clay than his Norman master, and might be found in the highways and byways of old England, laboring with a brass collar on his neck and the name of his master marked upon it. You were down then. You are up now. I am glad you are up, and I want you to be glad to help us up also. The story of inferiority is an old dodge, as I have said. For wherever men oppress their fellows, wherever they enslave them, they will endeavor to find the needed apology for such enslavement and oppression in the character of the people oppressed and enslaved. When we wanted a few years ago a slice of Mexico, it was hinted that the Mexicans were an inferior race, that the old Castilian blood had become so weak that it would scarcely run downhill, and that Mexico needed the long, strong, and beneficent arm of the Anglo-Saxon care extended over it. We said that it was necessary to its salvation, and a part of the manifest destiny of this republic, to extend our arm over that dilapidated government. So too when Russia wanted to take possession of a part of the Ottoman Empire, the Turks were an inferior race. So too when England wants to set the heel of her power more firmly in the quivering heart of old Ireland, the Celts are an inferior race. So too the Negro, when he is to be robbed of any right which is justly his, is an inferior man. It is said that we are ignorant. I admit it. But if we know enough to be hung, we know enough to vote. If the Negro knows enough to pay taxes to support the government, he knows enough to vote. Taxation and representation should go together. If he knows enough to shoulder a musket and fight for the flag, fight for the government, he knows enough to vote. If he knows as much when he is sober as an Irishman knows when drunk, he knows enough to vote on good American principles. But I was saying that you needed a counterpoise in the persons of the slaves to the enmity that would exist at the South after the rebellion is put down. I hold that the American people are bound, not only in self-defense, to extend this right to the freedmen of the South, but they are bound by their love of country and by all their regard for the future safety of those Southern states to do this, to do it as a measure essential to the preservation of peace there, but I will not dwell upon this. I put it to the American sense of honor. The honor of a nation is an important thing. It is said in the Scriptures, "What doth it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" It may be said also, "What doth it profit a nation if it gain the whole world but lose its honor?" I hold that the American government has taken upon itself a solemn obligation of honor to see that this war, let it be long or short, let it cost much or let it cost little, that this war shall not cease until every freedman at the South has the right to vote. It has bound itself to it. What have you asked the black man of the South, the black man of the whole country, to do? Why, you have asked them to incur the enmity of their masters in order to befriend you and to befriend this government. You have asked us to call down, not only upon ourselves, but upon our children's children, the deadly hate of the entire Southern people. You have called upon us to turn our backs upon our masters, to abandon their cause and espouse yours, to turn against the South and in favor of the North, to shoot down the Confederacy and uphold the flag, the American flag. You have called upon us to expose ourselves to all the subtle machinations of their malignity for all time. And now, what do you propose to do when you come to make peace? To reward your enemies and trample in the dust of your friends? Do you intend to sacrifice the very man who have come to the rescue of your banner in the South and incurred the lasting displeasure of their masters thereby? Do you intend to sacrifice them and reward your enemies? Do you mean to give your enemies the right to vote and take it away from your friends? Is that wise policy? Is that honorable? Could American honor withstand such a blow? I do not believe you will do it. I think you will see to it that we have the right to vote. There is something too mean in looking upon the Negro when you are in trouble as a citizen, and when you are free from trouble as an alien. When this nation was in trouble in its early struggles, it looked upon the Negro as a citizen. In 1776, he was a citizen. At the time of the formation of the Constitution, the Negro had the right to vote in 11 states out of the old 13. In your trouble, you have made us citizens. In 1812, General Jackson addressed us as citizens, fellow citizens. He wanted us to fight. We were citizens then. And now, when you come to frame a conscription bill, the Negro is a citizen again. He has been a citizen just 3 times in the history of this government, and it has always been in time of trouble. In time of trouble, we are citizens. Shall we be citizens in war and aliens in peace? Would that be just? I ask my friends, who are apologizing for not insisting upon this right, where can the black man look in this country for the assertion of his right, if he may not look to the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society? Where under the whole heavens can he look for sympathy in asserting this right, if he may not look to this platform? Have you lifted us up to a certain height to see that we are men, and then are any disposed to leave us there without seeing that we are put in possession of all our rights? We look naturally to this platform for the assertion of all our rights, and for this one especially. I understand the anti-slavery societies of this country to be based on 2 principles. First, the freedom of the blacks of this country, and second, the elevation of them. Let me not be misunderstood here. I am not asking for sympathy at the hands of abolitionists, sympathy at the hands of any. I think the American people are disposed often to be generous rather than just. I look over this country at the present time, and I see educational societies, sanitary commissions, freedmen's associations, and the like, all very good. But in regard to the colored people, there is always more that is benevolent, I perceive, than just manifested towards us. What I ask for the Negro is not benevolence, not pity, not sympathy, but simply justice. The American people have always been anxious to know what they shall do with us. General Banks was distressed with solicitude as to what he should do with the Negro. Everybody has asked the question, and they learned to ask it early of the abolitionists. What shall we do with the Negro? I have had but one answer from the beginning. Do nothing with us. Your doing with us has already played the mischief with us. Do nothing with us. If the apples will not remain on the tree of their own strength, if they are worm-eaten at the core, if they are early ripe and disposed to fall, let them fall. I am not for tying or fastening them on the tree in any way except by nature's plan, and if they will not stay there, let them fall. And if the Negro cannot stand on his own legs, let him fall also. All I ask is, give him a chance to stand on his own legs. Let him alone. If you see him on his way to school, let him alone. Don't disturb him. If you see him going to the dinner table at a hotel, let him go. If you see him going to the ballot box, let him alone. Don't disturb him. If you see him going into a workshop, just let him alone. Your interference is doing him a positive injury. General Banks, preparation is of a piece with this attempt to prop up the Negro. Let him fall if he cannot stand alone. If the Negro cannot live by the line of eternal justice, so beautifully pictured to you in the illustration used by Mr. Phillips, the fault will not be yours. It will be his who made the Negro and established that line for his government. Let him live or die by that. If you will only untie his hands and give him a chance, I think he will live. He will work as readily for himself as the white man. A great many delusions have been swept away by this war. One was that the Negro would not work. He has proved his ability to work. Another was that the Negro would not fight, that he possessed only the most sheepish attributes of humanity, was a perfect lamb or an Uncle Tom, disposed to take off his coat whenever required, fold his hands, and be whipped by anybody who wanted to whip him. But the war has proved that there is a great deal of human nature in the Negro, and that he will fight. As Mr. Quincy, our president, said, in earlier days than these, when there is reasonable probability of his whipping anybody.